You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, Trump goes to war with Australia. Not literally, but does it even matter anymore? Plus, the UK's Brexit plan is apparently becoming ever clearer. But does it make any sense? And later on, Punching Nazis, the film festival. I'll discuss those stories and more with my guests, Samira Shackle and Matthew Green, right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A very warm welcome to today's episode of Midori House. My guests today are Matthew Green, former Financial Times correspondent to West Africa, Pakistan and Afghanistan, and the freelance journalist and regular Monocle 24 contributor, Samira Shackle. Matthew, Samira, welcome. Great to have you both with us. Let's start today's programme with a bit of a sort of discussion about the... Well, I don't know. Sometimes it feels like it's the end of the world, but rather it's another wild week in statesmanship from the Trump White House.
That's a very generous term you use there, Tom.
Well, Matthew, let me come to you first of all. Let's go via Australia, because obviously Donald Trump had a call with Australia's Prime Minister. It seems it didn't exactly go to plan, and it seems actually, I don't know, he took issue and hung up, rather as you might expect a sort of angry teenager to do.
Yeah, well, that's certainly... accords with Donald Trump's psychological profile. Angry teenager is pretty appropriate. According to the report in the Washington Post, he did hang up the call after a sort of tense 25-minute conversation with Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull that was supposed to have lasted for an hour. The point of contention seems to have been this deal that the Obama administration took to take just over 1,000 refugees in a kind of swap for some other refugees that Australia would take from Central America. But yeah, I mean, you know, we're seeing this everywhere we look, aren't we? That's what happens when you put somebody, like I say, with this Donald Trump's psychological profile in the White House. It's bound to lead to disaster after disaster. And is anyone surprised?
And I guess, Samira, the point is here, okay, this is diplomatically fairly disastrous as things go, hanging up on a colleague and someone you're going to work together with. But it does rather make one fear what the next disaster could be. And does it go beyond diplomacy into something altogether more damaging even than that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's all the things that came up during the campaign, wasn't it? Is he temperamentally suited to be in charge of the nuclear codes being the logical extension of that argument? And I think everything we've seen so far indicates not, which, as Matt rightly says, shouldn't be surprising given that there's been literally nothing to suggest that he would have been temperamentally suited to any of that, or that he would have calmed down once in office, which is a sort of wildly optimistic theory that was put around by lots of people. But I mean, we haven't seen anything at all to suggest that. In fact, it's quite astonishing given what a short time it is since the inauguration. It's quite remarkable how much has been done in terms of these quite disruptive executive orders, diplomatic upsets and so on, but actually in terms of how much his own team and sort of internal aides and so on in the White House and beyond are briefing against him. Lots and lots of stories coming out about describing him as effectively a 70-year-old child, saying it's very difficult to get him to stop watching telly and looking at the internet and being really angry about things and just sort of raging. Yeah. And, you know, that's something that you might, obviously not those exact, exact criticisms, but
the criticisms.
I was about to finish that. Maybe not those criticisms. You'd expect to see some criticisms kind of maybe at the end of an 8-year spell in power, not within a week.
Isn't it quite comforting in a way, though, that even after 7 days, he's crashed through 50% disapproval rating, which has taken most presidents...
Well, I don't know.
Years.
It's remarkable.
It does give you some confidence in the American people. I mean, obviously, the kind of global facepalm moment that greeted those headlines that he'd been elected is still reverberating around the world. But it is encouraging to see the resistance gathering some sort of pace. Obviously, California is a hotbed of that. And we've just seen Arnold Schwarzenegger, the former governor, saying that people would sleep easier in their beds if he took over Trump's job. I think we could probably all agree with that. Absurd as that statement may have sounded even a few months ago, it does ring rather true these days.
Well, what about the bigger picture in terms of, you know, we know about Trump's skepticism, cynicism, or outright hostility towards, for example, the intelligence services. And, you know, the US and Australia share intelligence, as the US does with other allies. This is confirming, is it not, Matt, you know, our fears that, you know, even if it's politically expedient for Trump to maintain his relationships and work on them, his instinctive character traits overwhelm everything. You know, and the worry is that there's not the second.
Exactly, I mean, right. Yeah.
Samir was talking about, you know, his cabal around him. There just don't seem to be the immediate checks to rein that in.
No, well, the cabal around him is as bad or possibly worse than he is. I mean, look at Steve Bannon. I mean, need I say more? Yeah, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head. And I think Theresa May has learned this very quickly to her cost. Mm. We're not dealing with a normal politician. We're dealing with somebody who exhibits all the symptoms of a narcissistic personality disorder. They take slight at the smallest offence. They're obsessed by their image, by their level of popularity and so on, wanting endless praise for their so-called achievements. I mean, somebody with that sort of personality, I don't think is going to be capable of maintaining anything like a stable set of international relationships with America's allies. And I think politicians across the Western world are starting to wake up to that. I think we're still in a state of denial in the Theresa May cabinet, which is sad and actually, I think, embarrassing. But we've seen voices in Europe and elsewhere recognizing that we are dealing with essentially America's, I mean, I don't wish to sound hyperbolic, but it's increasingly President Trump's clearly displaying autocratic tendencies. And the phrase rogue state starts to spring to mind, doesn't it?
It does. That's a sobering thought for this early in the programme. Samir, I did want to touch briefly, actually, on some of the substance. I know, obviously, the Trump diplomacy angle rather prevails over the substance of what he was supposedly discussing with Malcolm Turnbull. But it is interesting that it's about this dispute around refugees and the processing of them. And we should, I guess, point out that, you know, Australia's policy in the first instance, you know, essentially they were trying to shunt a bunch of people that they have, one could argue, a responsibility for off somewhere else. You know, we're a bit of a risk of, we don't want to cast Australia as the kind of hero of the piece, because the policy at the heart there is also flawed. And as some have said, it's rather nationalistic, it's populist, it's racist, some people say. I mean, we should remember that.
Yeah, I mean, Australia's got absolutely heinous sort of immigration policies and policies around asylum seekers. The Nauru Island, where the refugees who are going to be resettled in the US come from, is like an absolute sort of catalogue of human rights abuses. It's people just being sent off to an island in the middle of the Pacific and basically imprisoned there with no opportunity to work in really horrendous conditions and so on. So certainly, I mean, that's a big, big issue. And I think it's also worth noting that members of Australia's government were actually quite approving about the Trump ban on people from seven Muslim majority countries going to the US. I mean, Australia didn't seem to think it was such a bad thing. But I mean, I think actually it almost makes it more remarkable that given that Australia has a fairly extreme stance on border policy, that Trump still, you know, I mean, I guess he doesn't really appear to have the capacity to take those kinds of things into account. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of a very immediate response to, I don't like what's being said in this conversation, therefore I'm going to say what I want, which is not really what you want from a president.
Because that was rather what struck me, Matt, this morning, was how bad must Trump be on this issue to, you know, pick a fight with the Australians?
Yeah,
when you would have thought they were rather in lockstep over.
We can't apply the usual model of rational actor to Donald Trump. Clearly, he's driven by internal psychological factors rather than any sort of rational appraisal of the national interest. I think that's pretty obvious. I suspect even to those who voted for him. I look forward to hearing from you in my inbox if you disagree.
I don't know what you're referring to there. Well, let's move on to another of this week's Trump-related news. This is this controversial raid in Yemen, which Trump approved, apparently without sufficient intelligence or ground support, as it appears. An investigating team from US Central Command concluded that civilians had been killed, allegedly including an 8-year-old girl. Samira, again, at the risk of repeating ourselves, you know, Donald Trump made a number of I don't know if you call it manifesto pledges, but he certainly made his view apparent about whether it's torture or attacking those around or close to terrorists, as he would say it, their families. Mm. He said he believed them to be legitimate targets. We shouldn't be surprised that we're seeing that happening.
No, we definitely shouldn't. I mean, I think, of course, I was thinking when I was reading about this that there is a slight risk of... I don't know, it's the sorts of thinking, because Trump it has made this blunder and probably will make more of sort of thinking that all that went before and US foreign policy and sort of military policy abroad was all smooth and good and great. And I mean, there's certainly been lots of civilian casualties in places like Yemen long before the Trump inauguration. But I agree, I mean, it's very little surprise that, you know, they say that it's, you know, was the result of going in without enough intelligence, enough planning. This is someone who repeatedly during his during the election campaign kept referring to his grand secret plan to defeat ISIS. There's no sign of what that secret plan is. We wait with bated breath. It seems to just be whenever he was pressed on it, it was sort of like, we're going to kill them and make America great again. It seemed to be pretty much the sum total of the plan, which he said was better than anything the army had come up with. But again, on this Yemen thing, I thought much as with the sort of stories coming out about his sort of predilection for watching telly and going on the internet from White House aides, that I thought it was quite remarkable actually that you've got military officials briefing so heavily against the president. I mean, that's quite remarkable that you've, you know, within days of inauguration got senior people from the military briefing against him saying that the decision was poorly made. So I think that's something to note.
Matthew, that's a good point that Samira raises there. I mean, are there comparisons? You know, do you recall other examples where, you know, a president or some kind of head of state or prime minister elected official is seemingly, you know, at odds with so many people in these senior ranks who are willing, as Samira says, to brief against him within whatever we are, kind of 10 days. I mean, it's extraordinary,
I mean,
isn't it?
From the details that have emerged, and obviously they need to be confirmed and so on, but the picture that is kind of coming out of what's happened seems to be that this raid had been on the list under Obama, but they'd kind of held back for various different reasons. And it was rapidly approved under the Trump administration. It led to the death of a senior Navy SEAL operator, as well as a large number of civilians, including an 8-year-old girl who is an American citizen, the daughter of the former head of the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Anwar al-Awlaki, who was an American citizen who was killed in a drone strike along with his 16-year-old son in 2011. I mean, in any other time, this would be an enormous story, but it's just somewhere sort of 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th on the list in the current turbulence that we're seeing in Washington. So, yeah, I mean, clearly there's going to be people in the Pentagon and other parts of the US military establishment who are extremely concerned. James Mattis, of course, has taken over as defense secretary, very well respected general. But is he, I mean, you know, there's some debate about whether he's fatally compromising himself by association or whether he'll be able to at least, I mean, it seems a bit sort of strange to use the kind of phrase island of sanity to describe the Pentagon, but in relative terms, keep the isolate the Pentagon from the sort of madness coming out of the White House.
Next on this, I want to talk about Iran, tested a cruise missile. Trump tweeted, his beloved form of communication, of course, that he's put Iran on notice. And Samira, we already touched briefly on the sort of the rhetoric of Trump. Again, it appears here, nobody really knows what Trump means, but is that maybe the point of the exercise?
Yeah, no one does really know what it means. I mean, he's given clear indications in the past that he would be in favour of reversing the Iran deal, which the nuclear deal which Obama reached after many, many years of negotiations. He wants to overrule that. He's, I think, referred to imposing more sanctions, but no one really knows what on notice means, if that's referral, if it's pure rhetoric, if it's a referral to sort of more sanctions, or if it's some sort of military escalation. It's completely unclear, as with much of what comes out of the Trump campaign. Trump, not campaign anymore, God, back.
But that is interesting. That is interesting, though, because every day is run like a campaign. It looks like he's still seeking the, you know, the daily PR victory. I wonder, though, Matt, actually, that's an interesting point that Samira makes. Is some of that deliberate, almost, the confusion, the mixed messages? You mentioned there that the Yemen attack and the death potentially of this American citizen would ordinarily be a huge story, but it's buried at item 10 in the day's mad meanderings. You know, Is that a strategy from Trump?
Well, I think it's a symptom rather than a strategy. I mean, there have been some reports, haven't there, that Steve Bannon, who seems to have been driving a lot of this over the last few days, has now incurred the president's wrath because he, at some level, is very sensitive to criticism, as somebody with his kind of profile would be. And it's, again, just reading some of the coverage earlier today, it does sound like he might even be trying to impose some more discipline. But I don't think it's possible, because I think at the end of the day, if you're in Trump's inner circle, you are at some level having to kowtow to his whims and his refusal to accept criticism and his megalomania and delusion. And he does live in his own sort of fantasy world. So, yeah, it's very hard to see how this is going to be anything more than a slow-burning debacle with hopefully, I mean, let's just hope the consequences are not as grave as they could well be.
Well, let's look in a bit more detail at another specific government program here. According to a Reuters report, the Trump administration wants to overhaul and rename an existing US government program designed to counter all violent ideologies, wherever they may be, to focus entirely on Islamist extremism. This comes in a week that a radical far-right white student shot and killed six innocent people in Quebec City at a mosque, of course, there. Samir, again, one can understand, given the rhetoric from Trump and Bannon and so on, and indeed the noise, the white noise through the campaign, maybe where this strategy, if we can call it that, has come from.
Yeah, I think it's completely unsurprising. I mean, his whole election campaign featured lots of very unabashed Muslim bashing and sort of real kind of scapegoating, quite racist rhetoric. I mean, his policies so far have shown that that was far from just being rhetoric, that was also part of the plan. I mean, obviously, there's been the huge furore over the executive order on travel bans and not letting people into the country from into the US if they're from certain countries. So I don't think this is surprising. It's a pretty stupid piece of policymaking, given that it's not sort of non-Muslim terrorism is not a small threat in the US. If you're talking comparatively, some figures that were compiled in 2015 found that there were twice as many deaths from terrorist attacks, by white supremacist or anti-government fanatics than there were from Islamic terrorists. So it's not an irrelevant threat. So if you're talking about tackling violent extremism, it's a misguided policy choice, but one that is sadly unsurprising.
But if you're seeking to instill fear in the population, exactly, and present yourself as an autocratic defender of the people, playing on the sort of most basic instincts in the human psyche, it's an extremely effective policy, isn't it, to scapegoat a particular religion or minority. It's the same psychology we see at work among parties like UKIP here. Nigel Farage is a great proponent of this ideology and a great fan of Trump. We see it echoed in the right-wing press by the Daily Mail, the Express and the Sun. We see powerful forces all around the globe who are trying to press those very basic psychological buttons that are embedded deep in the oldest parts of the human brain and make us scared of one another. And you know, we just need to stand up and stand against this. And thank God there are so many voices being raised in the US and around the world who can see right through this illusion, who can see right through the charlatanry that is being performed by these kinds of demagogue leaders like Trump et al. And we're now looking at a real fight for the future of the human project. And let's all get involved. Let's send money to the American Civil Liberties Union. Let's join organizations that are standing up to this. You know, we need to use every platform we have to resist and find ways constructively, peacefully, politely, respectfully to say no to this.
That's a bit of a call to action from Matthew Green. Inspiring stuff. Matthew and Samira Shackle will be with us when we come back. Coming up next, we'll talk a bit more about Brexit and we'll talk about punching Nazis.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto and New York City. In Hong Kong, our bureau chief is James Chambers.
There's no such thing as an ordinary day in Hong Kong. On any one day, I may be interviewing a city mayor or having coffee with a hotelier or chatting with an interior designer and then trying out the latest bar or restaurant. And mixed in with all of this, there'll be some wacky or outrageous news coming out of China which deserves to be covered on the radio. So it's this variety that I really love about the job.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
You're listening to Midori House, 20 minutes past the hour. Still with me are journalists Samira Shackle and Matthew Green. I was going to try and look for a slightly more, I don't know, sunshine story, but unfortunately, next we're coming back to the UK and talking Brexit. A white paper has just been released giving more details on the government's Brexit negotiating strategy. Samira Shackle, if we can call it that, isn't what's happening here that the more information we get, the more muddy the waters seem to be?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when Theresa May gave her speech last month, I guess it was at least sort of set out what they want. It wasn't, I don't think there's that much new in the white paper. I haven't read the whole thing through, but from what I've seen, nothing that much that builds on her speech. So we got a sense of what the British government wants, but not that much sense of how we're going to get there. So if you're sort of skimming through the white paper, it's like, oh, well, this is going to be great. We're just going to have a really great deal that's just great for everyone. But it's obviously quite optimistic, and I think on one reading of the white paper, I mean, that first of all, there's all sorts of things where it's like we're agreed that no one wants a bad deal. Well, obviously, I mean, that's we know that, but it doesn't give any indication of how that will be achieved. Ditto, I think the Northern Ireland question is absolutely huge. I mean, it does gives she said, I think the white paper says that the British government's committed, it sort of aims to make sure there's no reinstatement of a border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, but doesn't give any guarantee, you know, an aim is not a guarantee that that's not going to happen. And that's a huge, huge effect that could happen to peace in that region.
Absolutely. Matthew, I mean, Samira's right, isn't she? It's all well and good saying, well, it will be a smooth and orderly exit. You can say that till you're blue in the face, or red, white and blue in the face, but it's no guarantee. And we're still hugely short on detail, on substance, on critical
questions of
facts. Yes. Like this thing about the Republic and Northern Ireland.
Yeah, border. Of course. And it was very eloquently put in the speech by the Conservative MP and long-standing Europhile Ken Clark, who said, forgive me if I don't buy into this idea that when we walk away from the single market, we're suddenly able to strike wonderful trade deals with countries that are just queuing up to offer us favourable terms, that for some reason just haven't seen it in their interest to do so until now, that will magically change. And he drew an analogy with Alice in Wonderland, and I think that was very appropriate. Because this whole project is built on a fantasy, isn't it? It's built on the idea that we can walk away from this huge single market that Britain has been one of the chief architects of and not incur any costs and somehow come away from it better off as a result, when that clearly won't be the case. So again, it does feel, especially again, a lot of the, you know, right-wing tabloids, it feels like we're living in a kind of delusional reality, kind of manufactured reality at the moment. And again, we just I'm sure probably most of the people listening to this program can absolutely see that. And I actually think there's more and more people who voted Brexit who can also probably see that now. And that photo of Trump and May holding hands, I think, said it all, didn't it?
It said a lot. I'm not sure I can repeat what I thought when I saw that. Yeah. Samira, what about this idea of grasping the nettle when it comes to this Brexit question? Because as you said on these big substantive questions, somebody's going to have to make a decision, and soon, because we have a timetable which we're supposedly going to stick to. We can understand the reluctance. Clearly, it's palpable from May or others in the cabinet. How do we go about grasping the nettle? What is the direct actions that can be taken that actually move this from a glacial and fearfully slow pace to something that actually signposts a way forwards?
Well, I think May and her cabinet seem quite keen on doing things fairly quickly, but the point is that they all the sorts of statements that are coming out of the government at the moment seem to forget the fact that we're not negotiating in a vacuum. So we're negotiating with a whole host of European leaders who have absolutely no interest in making sure that things are all rosy and good and that Britain can leave the EU and be better off afterwards. Some of them have quite explicitly said that that's not the eventuality they want to see. And I thought in the speech May gave last month, her sort of threat to the EU seemed to be give us what we want or we'll make ourselves into a tax haven, which was a little bit grim if you're a British citizen listening to that. I mean, that just seemed to be what she's saying.
It's exactly what she said. And this is the other great irony, isn't it, of Brexit, that the idea we'd strike some wonderful new trade deal with the US, which would compensate for the losses we'll suffer from the EU. I mean, they're the toughest negotiators on earth, and with Donald Trump at the helm, we're not going to be getting any favours.
Certainly, if that phone call with Malcolm Turnbull, which we were talking about at the beginning, should give chills down anyone's spine, it should be Theresa May's. I mean, there's no guarantee that being a close ally is going to give any sort of preferential treatment, I think.
And isn't it sad also for all those poor people who voted for Brexit, thinking that they'd get more money for the NHS? The chances are that in any trade deal we do with the Americans, they'll demand that the health market in the UK is opened up, and we'll see the NHS gobbled up by US multinationals. Yeah, I mean, this is reality now that we're facing.
Yeah, it's almost as if the people who voted so enthusiastically for Brexit didn't really understand the consequences.
Well, Tom, I think that's a very controversial statement, and I'm not sure that I can endorse it. I think everybody who voted for Brexit had a completely thorough understanding of the intricacies of the common market or the single market in the customs union and all the economic implications. So I would challenge you on that.
Okay, I'm starting to worry a bit about you, actually, Dorothy. You're getting a bit despairing. Hang in there. Let's try and end on a note of, I don't know if this is levity exactly, but punching Nazis is a pretty good idea at the best of times, surely. And this weekend, a film event called Fash Bash, A Night of Nazi Punching on Film, will take place. It comes after the noted neo-Nazi, Richard Spencer, was punched in the face on camera. That's been viewed many a time. Ava Coffin, one of the organisers of the event, said, Fash Bash is a film screening of clips from movies in which people are resisting and protesting fascism. Of course it's taking place in Brooklyn. Samira, what do you think about this? I mean, we shouldn't make light of some pretty hefty issues, but this is a good idea, isn't it? It gets people back on side.
Yeah, it's quite funny. I can't imagine watching, I think it's 90 minutes long, 90 solid minutes of people getting punched, but I think they are going to be contextualising some of the clips as well with a few talks. So, yeah, it might get a bit relentless otherwise.
And what do you think? We said there's some kind of despairing tones that we've struck in this programme, and that's probably quite justifiably. Is this a sort of thing that would help?
I personally think this should be a phone-in, because I'm sure there's people out there who are very outraged with some of the comments we're making, and it would be wonderful to have their perspective. But yeah, I mean, punching fascists, obviously, yes, all for that. I mean, it sends a coded message, doesn't it? You know,
not that coded.
I mean, it's a moment where so many of us are feeling like these very dark forces are on the march, and it's a little bit of light relief, isn't it, for us? But, you know, at the end of the day, those of us who are on the progressive side have to be kind of better, don't we? And we have to rally and show an alternative vision and sort of, in a way, that's why I kind of hold back from wholeheartedly endorsing this kind of festival, because we've got to have the moral high ground.
We shouldn't be lashing out. And just, I mean, time is short, but in the last few seconds, in all seriousness then, yeah, you got to stick to your guns, metaphorically, of course, I mean.
Yeah.
But do you have confidence that that wins out in the end? Or are too many people going to be running around essentially punching each other in the face?
I think that we're going through a global process. I think a great deal of very difficult, dangerous material in our kind of collective consciousness is now rising to the surface, and it's frightening to see what's happening. I do believe that it will come to the surface so it can ultimately be transformed, but that is going to be a struggle that's going to take some years, and we've all got to get stuck in.
There we go. Another call to arms to end the programme. Matthew Green, Samira Shackle, thank you both very much indeed for being with us on Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's programme. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elisa Mayer, and our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next. 1900, The Urbanist is coming your way, and we'll have more on all the big stories of the day and some of the small ones on the Monocle Daily, 2200 London time. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Goodbye.